Payne is in the building.
O'clock in Toronto, TSN 1050. Richards 1-4. Sean Salisbury up in moments. Theme from Ballers, and we just found out actually today that they will be up for season number 3. They are currently now at season 2, and it has an interesting take on the life and the lifestyles of those that play professional sports in Ballers. If you have not seen it, that's The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, and his portrayal of the life of the professional athlete in the Miami area. But you know, it's interesting. We watch it as just viewers and fans, and we assume that it's kind of like that. I wonder for those who actually were able to play at the professional level and saw that up close, if it's even remotely like that. And for more, and of course, obviously, football talk, our good friend Sean Salisbury. First time I've had a chance to talk to him this summer. Good afternoon, Sean.
How you doing, Mike? Good to talk to you, buddy.
Hey, good to talk to you, too. You know, we were just talking about Ballers, and I just wonder, guys who actually, you know, really lived the life. Do you watch that show? Is it close to you? Is it accurate?
Have a good weekend. You know what? I don't watch it. I've seen previews of it, but I'd love to tell you if it was accurate or not. If somebody told me what went on with it, I probably could, but I actually do not watch it, so I can't answer that. I apologize.
Well, no problem, because really it sort of talks about, you know, and I guess the way that I would put it, Sean, is that I think if you are able to live the kind of life because of, you know, the God-given skills that you got. Sometimes it's guys were just born big. Sometimes guys just have a certain size, and they were able to sort of hone it in and get to a certain place in life. And because of that, and I'm not saying that people don't work for it or there's an enormous amount of sacrifice to be able to play professional football, because that would be a misnomer, because you know what it takes to play in that league. But I think that there are some guys who eventually get there, and they've just never really heard the word no. And I think when you are trying to teach, when you're trying to coach, when you're trying to educate and show these young men who are incredibly talented and real, real big with huge paychecks, that's got to be a tough place at times for those who just really don't understand the world in life. Because, let's be honest, Sean, some of these guys never heard the word no.
No, they haven't. And, you know, whether it's the word no about females, whether it's the word no about being on time, whether it's the word no about anything, you know, to be able to, you know, be on time for practice. Yeah, and not everybody. I'm not putting a blanket statement on them, but yes, they are. You know, you're talking about since the time most of these guys that are that good to get to that level have been. Now, a lot of them work hard. You just don't fall off a turnip truck and land in a professional sport. But to work hard, it's one thing to get there. It's another thing to stay there. And yeah, they've had people tell them how great they are. They've been enabled. They've been coddled. They've had rules bent for them. And not everybody, but it does. I mean, we see it every day at society. It's not just athletes. It's celebrities. It's actors. It's musicians. It's CEOs. We are in a time when guys, regardless if you worked hard or not, you get to a certain level. And then when everybody knows who you are and everything you do is in front of the world like the athletes are, sometimes those things without telling no can turn into a mistake and cost you. And then sometimes, you know, whether it's giving somebody power of attorney, and that's part of not saying no, you just turn it all over. When you're in that for the first time in your life on that stage, it becomes a problem. And like I said, I've heard about the show, don't watch it, but you are exactly right. When you haven't been told no and you've been enabled and you have had a red carpet rolled out for you all the time forever and everybody's telling you how great you are, to be able to delineate the two and be able to be a guy who trains like a backup and performs like a starter, not only as a player, but also in life, and doesn't forget the morals and values that they were grown up, you know, were raised with. People are going to make mistakes. The key is you don't always have to make the mistake. You can learn from somebody else's mistakes so you don't make the same mistake they do. But, and then it's the other side, you know, it's whether it's the financial hawkers, the females, the jock sniffs, guys and girl jock sniffs, they're out there too, and they make it very difficult. And when somebody's telling you how great you are or throwing stuff at you, at times it's difficult to say no. And then you realize it's better to prepare and prevent than repair and repent. And it's hard to do.
We're in conversation with Sean Salisbury here on TSN 1050, Richards 1 to 4. You know, Sean, in 1976, I had a chance to moved out to Eugene, Oregon. So I had season tickets at Autzen Stadium and watched a really bad University of Oregon team get smoked by everybody. It really wasn't what it has it evolved into out in Oregon. But people don't understand, you know, back in the day, I mean, there wasn't a lot there. I mean, USC would come into town. That was John Robinson's team, and they would put a pounding on him. Ricky Bell would be in the backfield. Charles White was the understudy. I mean, it was just one team after another come in and beat the hell out of these guys. And it wasn't until years later, and of course, what people would refer to now as maybe that Chip Kelly era, that it, you know, all of a sudden Oregon was just seen as a different kind of school, which means they could recruit differently. They could you know, achieve great levels and vie for national championships. And then you move forward to what Chip has done professionally, and it's a different universe. It's a different world. And as he goes from Philadelphia into San Francisco, and maybe to this moment, we still don't know who that number one quarterback is going to be. But how do you think this works for Chip Kelly in San Francisco? Because at this moment, I got a huge question mark, Sean. I really don't know.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people feel the same way, and that can be a good thing for your competition because they don't know, and it can be a bad thing if you don't have players. And I could tell you this, that when we criticize Chip Kelly, when you think about what he did when he first came in the league, when he didn't have the power of being the general manager and the head coach, when he first came to the NFL, and when he was in college, all he did was coach. He wasn't the athletic director. He would have a recruiting coach. And what'd they do? Change him around, put him in national title contention on a regular basis, turn them into a powerhouse. Well, you move forward to the NFL, Philadelphia, pretty darn good. You think about Nick Foles, who just got cut from St. Louis, had his best year under Chip Kelly. He does do things right. He does things uncharacteristic. He does things unconventional, but he can coach. The problem is a lot of people aren't able to divide the two. Chip Kelly, the general manager, quite frankly, ain't any good. His ego gets in the way. He's not good. When you give him that much power, I don't believe you can be a great doctor, an orthopedic surgeon, and a great lawyer and do them both great. So you don't. You focus on one. And other than a few aberrations in sports, Mike, and I believe this, you cannot do both great over a long period of time. I can remember sitting on the set at ESPN with my good friend Stuart Scott, God rest his soul, and about a year before, and not a pat on the back, but you could just see it, and I'm a Mike Holmgren fan. When he was in Seattle, I said, once he decides to either get fired from the GM role, they get rid of him, or he gives that up, the Seattle Seahawks will be in championship contention. They've got the people. And they made the playoffs in the next year, and I think they went on to win the Super Bowl, or go to the Super Bowl 2 years after that. So you just can't do both. If you want to put a coat and tie on, then be Pat Riley and go upstairs, put a coat and tie on. You want to coach, put a sweatshirt on and go coach your guys. So I think that's been the biggest problem with Chip. I don't think, while unconventional, as a GM, he cuts those players. As a coach, if he'd had, when they were there, LeSean McCoy and that group, they won. So, and there's better players in Philadelphia than there is in San Francisco now. So it's not usually the X's and O's. You give me all the X's and O's you want, but if you don't have the Jimmys and the Joes, it doesn't matter. So Chip's got his work cut out for him. They don't have a great quarterback. Gabbert, he's the starter. We know that Kaepernick's been up and down like the Dow Jones, so they don't have an explosive team. They may have the worst roster in the NFL right now, so he's got his work cut out for him. But I do believe that they will play better with him, with Balky as a front office guy. He's just the coach. When he's just the coach, good things happen. You don't have to do things conventional. Hell, a lot of guys do things unconventional in business, in sports. Rick Barry was unconventional in free throws, and he shot 90-some percent in his career. So I don't care how you skin the cat, just skin it. I just don't like when the head coach also has the power. You can't decide the coffee for the executive assistants and the players in the building and then go out and coach X's and O's. Pick one and do it. And I think now that he's back to being a football coach, it will bode well for San Francisco, but they're still the worst team in the division, I believe. And quite frankly, until they get players, Chip's got a long way to go with the players. But I know the guy can coach.
Well, Sean, I couldn't agree with you more than that, 100% on the issue of, you know, just pick one thing and be really good at that. I mean,
yeah,
I don't
absolutely.
Think, you know what, and you also brought up the fact that it's not just sports we're talking about. I'm just saying in life, it's okay to just be really good. In fact, you're lucky to be really good at one thing. When you think you can do both things, I don't care what sport we're talking about. And look, are there examples where guys have been successful? Sure. And usually those guys are in Hall of Fames or whatever they happen to be. But it is not the norm. Just pick one thing and be that. And I think, you know, when I take a look at, you know, just even almost, Sean, I think to a degree, there's almost, to me, a conflict of interest when that does happen, because you're so tied to what happens financially and all these other aspects that you might be, you know, there might be some areas that, that compromise your choices that you would make on the court, on the field, on the ice, on the pitch. And to me, I've just never understood why they lump that on a guy. Maybe it's a power thing. Yeah, it's ego, Sean, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's a power and ego thing, Mike. And, you know, if you can have a say, of course you're the coach you'd like a say. But look how good – everybody thinks Bill Belichick makes every – It's a dictatorship, and he makes every decision on it. No, when Pioli was there, and then now the current front office, they do a great job of feeding off each other, and Bill has say in it. But Bill's a coach first. Pete Carroll, look what he's done with Schneider in Seattle. Look at the rapport they have. Pete has a say, but we got a general manager, and he takes care of it. And once egos get put aside, and it doesn't matter who gets the credit, you'll win again. You will. And I'm going to tell you an underrated thing that nobody talks about. When it comes to players and when a coach wants to be the GM and the head coach, you know how players feel? We don't trust you.
Yeah.
Because one minute you're down there with us in the locker room grinding and kicking ass and doing all those things and sweating and going through the things that we as players and coaches go through that only we know about. And then after practice, you roll upstairs to negotiate my contract and you're putting a coat and tie on and a shower and slicking your hair back, and we don't trust you. It's like right now with the NFL, Roger Goodell in the NFL. We want to trust the front offices of the NFL and think that they have your best interest in mind when they sign your paychecks. And then you go to the owner, I mean the president, the CEO, the boss of the league, the commissioner, and it's like, oh, does he really? And it's the same thing. When you're the coach, we love you. We want to. We trust that you're going to get down there and get dirty with us and do the things that we do and sweat with us, and nobody knows. And then you're going to walk upstairs after you just watched me practice and told me how much you appreciate the way I work, and then go upstairs and be the GM and tell me I'm not worth $2 extra million a year when my contract comes up. You lose trust when you do both. We don't want our coach to be in a suit in the locker room. We want our coach to be in a sweatshirt and just one of us. And when you go upstairs and do it, that's why you hear the term, oh, he's a suit now. We don't trust the guy. And, I mean, sometimes we try to, but we have a lot more trust when a guy's just like a coach, because we feel that he's one of us. When he goes upstairs, you start to feel like it's too much business and not enough emotion.
I hear that. We are in conversation with Sean Salisbury here on TSN 1050, Richards 1-4. And for Jimmy Garoppolo, I mean, you know, a lot of people, unless they watch a lot of Eastern Illinois football, they may not know a bunch about this guy, but I keep hearing about football IQ. I keep hearing about, you know, sort of his mental ability, which is all great. I mean, hey, it all goes into it. As you know, Sean, you played the position, but at some point you need things to go away your way. You need protection. You need guys to be open. Their first game of the week is against the Arizona Cardinals. That's a tough matchup, week number one.
Yeah, it sure is. And you hear all the, and it's all fine and dandy, but the window that he threw in high school was about 8 yards. The window he threw in at Eastern Illinois was about 7 yards. The window he's going to be throwing it to now is about the size of a coffee can. So the anticipation, the ability, the offseason, all those things, you can't simulate it. Now, Bill Belichick is one of the best at putting his players under duress on the practice field, so it doesn't look much different come game time. Even with Tom Brady going to Arizona in the opening game of the season, that was going to be, there'd be people that would have picked Arizona to win that game. That is a brutal place to start for Garoppolo, but hell, why not? Let's go test him now. Then he gets to play three at home. He gets the Dolphins, I believe, at home, but Buffalo, I believe, at home, and he's also got a short week when he plays the Texans at home. And, you know, Bill will be playing, you know, coaching against Brock Osweiler, who got him last year when he was in Denver. And Bill, usually it's tough to get him twice in a row. So I think Jimmy can go 2-2 or 3-1. I do. Now, here's the one piece of advice that I would give him that my good friend, and God rest his soul, and a guy that was like family to me, and Benny Green, would tell me. I could never forget it. My first start, he told me every time I played, he said, drive the bus. He said, it was real simple. He said, know who to get and how to get him, and just drive the bus, meaning you don't have to go out and throw for 500 every play. You don't have to hit a grand slam every play. When you're driving the bus, what do we do if we're a bus driver with our children? Get them there safely. And what do we do if we're a bus driver and we're driving teammates? Just make sure they feel comfortable. There's not a lot of bumps in the road. Don't make any quick turns where they fall out of their seat, and get them there safely and let them do their job too. And I took it to heart in my piece, drive the bus. You're not Tom Brady. We're not going to make you do what Tom does. We're not going to ask you to do what Tom does mentally. Take care of your business. If you protect the football, we'll go 3-1. If he does not turn the ball over, they will go minimum 3-1. If he turns the ball over, now it's a problem. So, yeah, is it tough? But guess what? That's why he gets paid. That's why we drafted him. I know he's young, but, hell, it's grown man football, man. And he's about to find out just what it's like from Eastern Illinois to a rookie and, you know, to early on in New England. And he's about to go play about the biggest grown man football game he's ever played in his life when he opens up against Arizona. And it's good for him. But one thing I promise you, he won't be. He may make some mistakes because of nerves and the rest of it. He will not be underprepared. That's one thing I can promise you with Bill Belichick. So I think Jimmy will be fine. They'll be happy to get Tom back. But you know what? These four games, quite frankly, are probably going to be the difference in whether New England's playing at home in the playoffs or whether they're going on the road. And that's how fine the line is between the starter and the backup. He must go 2-2 to give them a you know, it's a tough conference that they play in. Cincinnati and Baltimore will be better, and Pittsburgh and Denver. And I know they replaced them. I mean, the Oakland Raiders are going to be, I mean, it's tough. So these four games matter, and that's why backups are so important. And Jimmy Garoppolo has an amazing test ahead of him, but fortunately gets three of them at home.
Well, you mentioned, you know, when you talk about the Arizona Cardinals, you're also taking a look at now. Do you know Carson Palmer? Is that someone you know
very
personally?
Very well. Yeah. No, I've known him a long time. Yes, he's one of the nicest, best humans in this league. And if you when you're just talking about throwing the ball down, there's only, to me, the two best pure throwers in the league when talking about pushing the ball down the field are him and Ben Roethlisberger. But last year's playoff game, Mike, you know, in the playoffs when they got eliminated, there's a chip on Arizona's shoulder. They didn't like the way they played. Carson did not like the way he played, nor should he, because he played awful. And the question on him is now, is he just a great regular season player where he can throw for all the yards? They got something to prove in Arizona, but they do have the roster to do it.
And I think that's also a good way to play football. I mean, you played it professionally. You played it at the highest of college levels. I don't mind guys playing with a chip on their shoulder.
If you don't, then you're probably playing the wrong sport. Then you might want to take 2 weeks off and quit. I think about now, when the chip on your shoulder is so big that it distracts you from doing your job because you want to get even with the defensive player, or you're trying to prove something to some fan sitting in the eighth row who's never done it, like, I mean, is booing you, but they're not putting their ass on the line like you are. The key is to take that chip and apply it to whatever it is that brings out the best in you. Tom Brady, still after all these years, he finds something to make him carry a chip. Well, being drafted in the sixth round, he's always carried that. Look what it's done. Last year, the deflate gate, he carried that chip and went out and had a monster season and had them knocking on the Super Bowl door. This year, I assure you, after game four and taking the suspension, he's going to be irritated. He's going to carry that chip. They, great players, no matter what, Drew Brees and when San Diego ran him out. Russell Wilson's too small. Emmitt Smith was too slow. I mean, great players in any sport. They play in coaches. It's okay to have a chip. Heck, I put one on my whole career. I thought I should have been drafted high. I blew out my knee twice and didn't. And I carried a chip for 10 years. I said, well, you know what? You may not have drafted me, but I'm going to outlast most of the guys that were drafted ahead of me just because of the injury. I'll show you how tough I am. And I carried it through my whole career and used it to my advantage. It's when the chip becomes a detriment and becomes a grudge that you start to suffer. When that chip is used for your advantage, it can be a great thing, and I like the team. Teams or players that don't have a chip on their shoulder in the right way probably aren't very good, to be honest with you.
Sean, before I let you go, this week in talking to people from various sports, you'll probably be the first, I think, professional athlete that I've asked this question of. And we got into the conversation of sports best owner. Now, there's a couple of things, and it's almost like criteria that goes into it, because if you're a player, you're probably going to see ownership differently than, say, the fan does. The fan wants to see inexpensive seats. They want to see championships. There's certain things that they want to see that is the opposite of the needs of the player. So you kind of got to define it a little differently when you're talking to people. But for you, and I know of the different owners that you played for, but for also those that you have rubbed shoulders with, to you, who's a good owner in professional sports?
Yeah. You know, I think that's an awesome question. It's so hard to answer. I played for some good owners, but I always think, too, about the Mara family in New York and the Rooney family in Pittsburgh and the Hunt family in Kansas City. Old school, classy, do it the right way. Here's how we're going to approach our business. We're going to set our rules in stone, and you're going to abide by them from now, from the 70s to now. Now, there are things, and just the one thing that some of those owners, the problem they have changed, you get so set in your ways. For instance, a guy like Antonio Brown, and I'm vehemently against usually not negotiating a contract until the guy's in the last year, not 2 or 3 years before. But in this case, the best wide receiver in the game, and he's highly underpaid. They'll only do it for quarterbacks. Maybe Pittsburgh has to change their ways in ownership and front office, say, know, maybe we do need to pay this guy because he still shows up. He doesn't hold out. He does his thing. That's for another conversation we can have with that, Mike. But to me, great owners do this. I'm going to keep it pretty simple. There's a lot of different ways. One, they got their teams back. No matter what, they got their teams back, meaning it doesn't matter what my coach or players do, as long as they're obeying the law and not only drugs or doing the stupid things we've seen some NFL players do. But they got their coach. They don't throw them under the bus in the media. If we're going to air our dirty laundry as an owner, we air it in the same meeting room and we hash it out without the USA Today or ESPN or Yahoo Sports or TSA, without them being part of it. That's number one. Number two is, and I firmly believe this, the best owners in this sport, they sign paychecks, they support their coach, and they let their coaches coach and their general manager take care of his business. That's why you empower a general manager to take care of the football stuff in the business suit. You empower the general manager to hire the head coach with your approval as long as he meets your moral standards and all that. And then you allow him to do his job. You don't micromanage the general manager every move he makes. You give him a budget or you give him, and you talk to him. And then finally, you hire a coach through with the general manager that you say, that's my guy and I believe in him. Set up in the box. I don't need you standing by me on the sideline until the end when we're shaking hands. Stand up there. You take your job and take your box. Let the general manager take his seat. And then I'll go take mine with my head coach on the sideline. Don't be a micro guy. Write the paychecks. Give them all the love you need. But most importantly, anytime we have dirty laundry or need to air it, we air it as a team, as a management, as a coach. We don't air it to the outside world first and don't have to hold a grudge. You keep it in-house. And right now, in my opinion, no team does that better than the New England Patriots and the San Antonio Spurs, period.
Sean,
that ownership in both are the best in football right now and basketball.
I got to tell you, I mean, that's so bang on. Look, I never get a chance to talk to you enough, if you ask me. I love having you on the show.
Well, let's do it. If you guys want to do like we let the Mike, you know I'm here for you every week, brother. I love talking to you. You do a great job. You guys are classy, and we carry this on whenever you want. You let me know when our guy gets back in town from his vacation, and we'll go for it.
We'll absolutely do that. Hey, you have a great summer, too, and we're going to pick this up again very shortly, but loved having you on the show today, as I do all the time, and we'll talk very soon, Sean.
Can't wait, buddy. Thanks.
Sean Salisbury joins here this afternoon. To me, I don't know if anyone, you know, there's a couple of guys that we talk to, some on a regular basis, some we don't. During the football season, we talked to Sean Salisbury, and I don't know if anyone really articulates it with the same kinds of passion, with the same kind of accuracy that Sean Salisbury does. One of my favorites. On the same time, someone we don't get to talk probably enough to, who very much on an intellectual level understands the game as good as anybody on this planet, that's Chris Schultz. When we have Schultz on, I feel the same way. It just, the time goes way too fast. Like it's 3:22. And I could have done a whole hour, and it's just so much passion and understanding of the sport that comes out. He's one of my favorite guests. He truly is. Bottom of the hour, Devin Bagby. He plays Connor Donovan, Ray Donovan's son. God, that's such a good show. I want to be Ray. Dude. But I'm probably Mickey. First, the News Talk 1010 traffic and weather update. Here we go. .329 TSN 1050, Richards 1-4. So thrilled. Devin Bagby, who plays Connor Donovan. Oh, it's such a good show, Ray Donovan. What a gig that is. That is so awesome. He's going to join us here in a couple of minutes. I can hardly wait. It's going to be great. You think of the gigs that you can have. It's this one. Everyone loves that show. .33 TSN 1050, Richards 1-4. I don't know how many times we've talked about Ray Donovan in the last, I've been away most of the summer. I've come back for 1 week. I think we've talked about it every day. But it is one of those shows that has grabbed everyone's attention. So what's it like to work on such a show that, you know, in everyday conversation, it's going to get dropped. For Devin Bagby, who plays Connor Donovan, going to join us in a second. And he works with the legendary John Voight, playing his grandfather as Mickey Donovan.
Hi, Grandpa.
What are you doing here, Connor?
Well, Mom found the joints, and I think Dad's going away somewhere.
What do you want me to do about it?
Just that.
I'm pretty goddamn disappointed in you, Connor. You don't just show up here.
You said to come at any time.
Well, this ain't the time.
That's right. You are an
And now to the airwaves we bring Devin Bagby. Good afternoon, Devin.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Oh, man. First of all, thank you for creating a great character. First of all. And I also will not bore you or attempt, like you probably get every day with people doing the Boston accent, because I would have to think after a while, it's got to be okay. I get it. It's a show, though, right? I'm not from, you know, and even in the show, you don't do the Boston accent. But look, it's one of those contagious things that, you know, even in the show, when Abby, who is your mom in the show, you know, gets told that the accent is charming, you know, they just get it all the time. But man, this creation to be a part of this, it's got to be a very exciting time for you, Devin.
It is. It is. And it's funny you say that about the Boston accent, because I think at least once a day someone has a horrible Boston accent and comes up to me like, kinda doing kinda.
Yeah, but, you know, and of course, I've been torturing people all week doing that. And of course, now I'm not doing it. They're going, "You phony, Richards. You're such a phony." But the show itself. So Devin, these things don't get handed to you. So the process. You're a working actor. This is not your first job. So therefore, you know, I guess sometimes the stars are aligned. It takes a little bit of luck. How does the role end up landing on your lap?
You know, I just. I was actually very fortunate to book this because I had just started acting 6 months before. And I just went to every audition I could. I think I went to over like 100 auditions before I even booked this. And when I booked this, it was like one of those auditions you get and you're like, that'd be nice, you know? And I was like, working with Liev Schreiber and John Voight. Yeah, right. They're not going to book a newbie. And then I end up booking it, and I was like, oh, hell yeah. I'm stoked.
So when you walk out, because people have to understand the audition process is kind of grueling. Sometimes you're sitting out there in the lobby, or, you know, generally, and there's a lot of guys that they're your age. They have your look. The hair looks the same. You know, you talk to people who have been at auditions, and you look around the room, and you're thinking, so what is going to be, like, the distinction between me and this guy? And sometimes, just sometimes, you know those other guys. Sometimes you've seen them work before, or by reputation in other auditions, you've seen them. Did you feel at some point as you're looking around, or when you went into audition, what do you take with you? I mean, what do you think got you this role?
You know, this specific casting director that booked me for Ray Donovan was very smart about what he did. His name was John Papsidira, and he tried to not have more than one person in the lobby at all times, because he knows sometimes actors get intimidated and sometimes they don't do their best work if you're sitting in the same room as someone that's in every movie. So I went, and this place was actually insane. It was in Hollywood, and you open this door, and there's a giant pool, there's palm trees, and he really wants, like, the people that come and act for him to feel at home. And I relaxed and just talked with some of the people, and I was in a really good state of mind, and I had the audition, and they were just really cool, and it didn't really feel like an audition. It just kind of felt like you were acting or just, I don't know, playing a character. And I ended up doing really well, I guess. And I went back like 3 or 4 times until I actually booked it.
Well, I mean, and you work with, now, Paula, who plays your mom, I think she's actually from Belfast, correct?
Yes, she's from Belfast.
So, and I would say this, being from an Irish background, the swearing is kind of the same. It's just with a different accent. And,
yeah.
And the way that she goes about it, I mean, people would swear that she was actually Boston Irish when she's not at all, and yet she's got that thing down perfectly.
Yeah, it's funny because she has the thickest Irish accent in person.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a change. And then Liev Schreiber, when I first, I mean, look at all the roles he's had in his lifetime, I thought, am I going to picture him as Boston Irish? I mean, in my head, I couldn't really see it. And that only takes about 5 minutes just because of his presence. And I'm just curious, you're so new to this. And as I said, yet you have booked other jobs. So this is just a huge one in the first 6 months of your career. When you're working with a Liev Schreiber, for instance, I mean, it's got to be different than I would think John Voight. And John Voight, to me, is this is maybe my most favorite thing that he's ever done. He's just a genius in this thing. But what do you get from them? Because there must be some sort of personal connection you have with them off the set, I'm guessing.
I do. I'm close with both of them. And they're different. They definitely are different, but they're both very, very professional. Liev is a perfectionist. If something is wrong in the scene, even if it's the smallest thing, he will fix it and make it to the point where it's completely believable. And that's what we really like pride ourselves on, is the how real our show is. And yeah, Liev is a perfectionist, but John also is very professional. And it's crazy because he's the nicest guy you'll ever meet. But when he's on set, you just see everything change. His body language, the way he looks at things, just the way he stands, the way he talks, everything just completely changes. And it's like watching a whole nother person.
Well, the characters they've created too, so Bunchy, Terry, I mean, and you get the feeling, and this is where I think, you know, the casting director deserves so much credit, because it does, even though as dysfunctional as it is, it does feel like a family when you watch the show.
Yeah, that's one thing about the Donovans is, no matter what happens in the outside world, they're loyal to each other. And that's why people love the show so much, is because it's like a real family, even though they're all fucked up in their own ways.
Well, you know what? I agree when the one kid knocked the cell phone out of your hand and you pushed him down the stairs. I like that.
That was a while ago.
But see, here's the thing with being on an HBO show that you have to be aware of, and this is what I try to be careful with when I'm on the radio. People, when they catch up, some people, you know, they binge watch. So, for instance, I'm not done season two, so I haven't started season three yet, so I don't talk about anything specific. Do you find that to be, I mean, look, you're an actor, so you got to kind of keep it to yourself, but do you find that being in a show this big that now has these seasons, you got to be careful what you say?
In a sense, it's weird for me because, I've always had a good part, but this season four that we're on right now is the best season for me by far. So when people talk about my character, they always are talking about previous seasons. When my character is completely changed in this season, and they made me a very dynamic character in the show. So it's hard to talk to people about it because they know the old Connor, and there's a completely new Connor this season.
Well, that I mean, how great for you for an actor, though, too. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is what makes you.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I'm very blessed.
So that means, so now are you a San Diego guy to begin with? Like, that's where you grew up?
Yes, born and raised.
So, no, okay, well, let's talk about this. Then in sports, are you a Chargers fan? Are you, God forbid, a Padres fan? What are you a fan of any sport?
I'm actually a huge Chargers fan.
Yeah.
I love my sports.
So what happens, but, what happens if they move, though? Are you going to be disappointed if the Chargers move?
You know, I don't like to believe that they're going to move. I'm going to keep a positive mindset of them not moving. But if they do move, I'm going to feel a little betrayed.
Yeah, well, I think that there could be a lot of people. And you know what? Don't betray a Donovan.
Yeah,
that's what I know, because Ray's going to show up in that office for sure. Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time with me, Devin, this afternoon. I said the job that you guys do is fantastic. It's one of the most popular shows on the planet, and a lot of credit, as I said, also goes to the casting director. But you create that guy. You create Connor. You create that son. So a big part of this goes to you as well, and we're huge fans of the show. So I appreciate that you took the time with us here this afternoon.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Devin Bagby calling us from San Diego. That is Connor Donovan. And yes, I refrained from calling him Kana. You see? See what I did there?
You're a phony, Richards.
Yeah, I know that. And guess what? That's what I get paid for. .348 TSN 1050. Richards 1-4. Thanks to Devin Bagby, Connor. Donovan. I didn't do that. I know. I know what I did. Looking at the leaderboard, Jimmy Walker, who finished earlier on with a 565, still leads. Martin Kaymer is 4 under after 10. Sneddon, 3 under through 13. He's still going. But there's a bunch in here that have teed off later on, so we'll give you up to date. And Fergie will be in later on to tell you about those scores as well. Right now, I think I'm looking up. Is that Bubba out there playing away? So we'll take you to New Jersey. We talked to Bob Weeks earlier today in that if we're looking at some of the names we thought would do well, well, Jason Day, who literally just picked up his clubs on Wednesday or whatever he did, goes out, shoots a 268. So did Jonathan Vegas. So Johnny Vegas was right there, both of them right there. But the name that people thought would be prevalent this weekend and this week, McIlroy. And Rory was a plus 4 today, shooting a 74. I know a lot was expected, and for Rory, he had a horrible day putting. Again, if he's in the same category after, and again, it's Thursday, I understand that, but you probably, if you're Rory, don't want to be in the same category and the same finish, which is T-133. So you're in the same group as John Daly, Vijay Singh. That's not good. Maybe if it was 10 years ago, maybe acceptable. And what would he have been? 11? I don't know. I'm just saying, not good. Patrick shot a plus 1 today. But I think of the rounds and the players that you want to follow a little bit, I still think that Ricky Fowler had a nice round at the minus 2 because aside from a great start to the season, he's been a no-show. So you're still probably going to want to watch Jason Day and Johnny Vegas. Good for him. 351 on TSN 1050 at the top of the hour. Of course, we're going to have the boys Overdrive. Who's on Overdrive today?
Scotty Mac and Jim Taddy.
Tats and Mac. They got something clever like that? Are they doing something weird?
Usually.
Yeah, they're doing something like that?
Yes, guy.
Tune in to find out.
All right. Yeah, you do have to tune in to find out. Thanks also to those who joined us today. Jonah Carey, who's always a lot of fun. Appreciate him joining us from CBS Sports and Sports Illustrated. We had Bob Weeks. Weeksy talking, obviously, about the PGA Championship. We'll do it again tomorrow. Also on tomorrow's show, from Barstool Sports, we have...
David Portnoy.
Portnoy, another Boston guy.
Yes.
And again... I'm not going to do the Boston. You can't do the accent to the people who actually have the accent.
Loved hearing Salisbury's voice today too.
Sean Salisbury is one of my favorite guys. Is that Jim Taddy? Is this a paying job for Jim Taddy? Does anyone know? Does he get paid by the hour?
I think he's selling real estate out there.
Yeah. Well, sold me my house.
Did he
it's
really?
True. That beautiful house that I have, that I go and show all the pictures to people. That was a Jim Taddy production.
That's a nice commission check, right there.
Yes, it is. Yeah. What's he even doing here? How many TSN stations does he work for, too? Now it's getting weird. He's like a Klitschko. Maybe there's more than one. I can't tell.